with VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Western powers called on Monday for calm in Bangladesh after long-ruling leader Sheikh Hasina fled, with the United States saluting the military for forming an interim government rather than cracking down further on protesters. The United States called on all sides in Bangladesh to refrain from further violence as bullet-ridden bodies were strewn across hospital floors and looting swept the capital of Dhaka.
Too many lives have been lost over the course of the past several weeks, and we urge calm and restraint in the days ahead.
A U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller Hasina, the daughter of Bangladesh's founding father, had sought to quell a nationwide uprising that started with student-led protests against job quotas. Nearly 100 people were killed on Sunday as calls grew on her to step down. Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says nearly 40,000 Palestinians have been killed in close to 10 months of fighting. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA.
Palestinian officials say hospitals have stopped functioning and are in urgent need of equipment. Khalil al-Dakran is the spokesperson for the health ministry in Gaza. He says there is an urgent need for beds, medicine, and medical supplies. More than 90% of Gaza's 2 million people have been displaced at least once and are spending the sweltering heat of the summer in tents with no air conditioning and few sanitation facilities. The fighting is showing no signs of letting up, and people on both sides see no hope for an end anytime soon. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
As Iran threatens to respond to the suspected Israeli assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh, and Tehran, the regional militias that the Islamic Republic has armed for decades could play a role in that attack. They include Lebanon's Hezbollah, the Houthi rebels of Yemen, Shiite militias in Iraq, and others. This is VOA News. The U.S. State Department said Monday it had been in contact with Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia on a path forward for Venezuela following last week's disputed elections.
When you look at the tallies that the opposition made public, it's clear that even if every outstanding vote came back from Maduro, it wouldn't be enough to overcome the advantage that Edmundo Gonzalez had.
U.S. officials said last week that electoral manipulation had stripped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's claim of re-election victory of any credibility, and Washington left the door open to fresh sanctions on the OPEC nation. U.S. Vice President and Democratic Party presidential nominee Kamala Harris is expected to announce her running mate on Tuesday, AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
After a weekend spent interviewing finalists, Vice President Harris must decide on her partner before the two set off Tuesday on a tour across key battleground states. Harris interviewed at least three running mate contenders on Sunday in Washington. They were Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. That's according to a person familiar with the process who spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity to discuss the negotiations. I'm Shelley Adler.
Pope Francis has accepted the resignation of Cardinal Sean O'Malley as Archbishop of Boston and named the current Bishop of Providence, Rhode Island, Richard Henning, to replace him as leader of one of the most important Catholic archdioceses in the United States. The announcement from the Vatican Monday did not mention O'Malley's other main role. He's been the Pope's main advisor in fighting clergy sexual abuse as head of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. O'Malley acknowledged on Monday that the terrible scourge of sexual abuse, but says he's full of hope. Elon Musk has filed a second lawsuit against OpenAI and two founders, Sam Altman and Greg Brockman. Musk claims he is suing over betrayal of the ChatGPT maker's founding names and benefiting the public good rather than pursuing profits. The lawsuit filed in a Northern California federal court called Musk's case a textbook tale of altruism versus greed. In response to the first lawsuit, OpenAI released emails from Musk showing his earlier support for making it a for-profit company. Spokesperson for OpenAI says Elon's prior emails continue to speak for themselves. Recapping one of our top stories, Western powers are calling on calm for Bangladesh after long-ruling leader Sheikh Hasina fled. The United States saluting the military for forming an interim government rather than cracking down on further protesters. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Sheikh Hasina resigns her premiership and flees the country.
Protesters stormed her residence in the capital of Dhaka and began looting one of the most protected buildings in the country.
Plus, stock markets around the world shed value.
Well, clearly investors are nervous, and as usual, it's easier to observe the market reactions than to explain it. So clearly, also, there are concerns about recession, but they're not the only ones.
And concerns about escalating tensions in the Middle East as calls for a ceasefire continue. Today is Tuesday, August 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Bangladesh Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina resigned and fled the country on Monday after hundreds of people were killed in a crackdown on demonstrations that began as protests against job quotas and swelled into a movement demanding her downfall. Reuters' Sean Hogan is up first.
As Bangladesh Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina resigned on Monday and fled the country, protesters stormed her residence in the capital of Dhaka and began looting one of the most protected buildings in the country. Elsewhere in the city, they chiseled away at the face of a statue of her father, state founder Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, with an axe. India's ANI news agency said 76-year-old Hasina landed at a military airfield near Delhi. Reuters could not immediately verify this, but commercial tracking services showed a Bangladesh Air Force plane leaving the country and flying west before it disappeared. The news of her exit was delivered by Army Chief General Waqar Uzzaman in a televised address. He said after a discussion with political leaders, an interim government would be formed.
Please keep faith and trust in the army. I take the responsibility and I promise to protect the lives and property of the people. Don't lose faith in the army. God willing, we will fulfill your demands and bring peace and harmony back to the country. I request to you all to support the army and stop the violence, murders, hooliganism, and the protest.
Bangladesh has been engulfed by violence after student protests began against quotas, which reserve some public sector jobs for veterans of Bangladesh's 1971 independence war, and some of the worst violence since the birth of the South Asian nation more than five decades ago. About 250 people have been killed and thousands injured. It escalated into a campaign to oust Hasina, who won a fourth straight term in January in an election boycotted by the opposition. In defiance of a nationwide curfew, there was jubilation as thousands of people marched in the streets of the capital.
We will never forget the student martyrs who have freed us today. They will always be in our heart.
Reuters reporter Sean Hogan. The United Nations says nine staff members of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, may have been involved in the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. Faran Haq is a deputy spokesperson.
Now we found out of those 19 that in 10 cases there's either no information or insufficient information to support the allegations of their involvement in the October 7th attacks. The nine of four of whom there is sufficient information will be terminated, and that of course includes some who had been terminated earlier in the immediate aftermath of the reporting.
The United Nations launched the investigation after Israel charged that 12 UNRWA staff members took part in the Hamas-led October 7th attacks that triggered the war in Gaza. And earlier in the day, the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah said it launched a drone attack Monday on northern Israel that the Israeli military said wounded two of its troops. As Israel braces for additional attacks by Iran and Hezbollah, families of Israeli hostages still held in Gaza marked 300 days last week since the start of the war, with marches and gatherings and warnings that time is running out. In Gaza, the death toll approaches 40,000, and health officials warn of growing health crises as hepatitis cases surpass 100,000. Linda Gradstein continues her coverage.
Thousands of people marched through the streets of Jerusalem wearing labels with the number 300 on them. The march was organized by Rachel and John Goldberg Poland, whose 23-year-old son Hirsch was among those kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival October 7th. They have worked tirelessly for his release. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he is working to bring the hostages home, but hostage families and more recently some in his military establishment have accused him of acting slowly and adding new conditions for a deal with Hamas on a gradual ceasefire that would free the hostages. Netanyahu says that Israel will strike wherever it needs to, including in Yemen and in Beirut. But he says Israel will reach out in peace to those who want peace. In Gaza, the death toll is rising, with the Hamas-run health ministry saying nearly 40,000 Palestinians have been killed in close to 10 months of fighting. Palestinian officials warn of a growing health crisis and are calling on the world to intervene. Dr. Majid Abu Ramadan is the Palestinian health minister in the West Bank. He says disease in Gaza is spreading and there are more than 100,000 cases of hepatitis. Palestinian officials say hospitals have stopped functioning and are in urgent need of equipment. Khalil al-Dakran is the spokesperson for the health ministry in Gaza. He says there is an urgent need for beds, medicine, and medical supplies. More than 90% of Gaza's 2 million people have been displaced at least once and are spending the sweltering heat of the summer in tents with no air conditioning and few sanitation facilities. The fighting is showing no signs of letting up, and people on both sides see no hope for an end anytime soon. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
The State Department says Secretary Antony Blinken is urging all parties involved in the Middle East to avoid escalation of tensions. But Matthew Miller, State Department spokesperson, speaking to reporters, says ultimately a cessation of violence is not a decision the U.S. can make.
It requires the parties to take these choices, and it requires the parties to get to yes, and not look for reasons to delay and not look for reasons to say no. And so the message that we have consistently communicated to everyone in the region is we want to see a ceasefire. We think a ceasefire is in the interest of Israel. It's in the interest of the Israeli people. It's in the interest of the Palestinian people. It is in the interest of the broader region.
He added that the United States will continue its diplomatic efforts to that end. In addition, defense officials say that several U.S. personnel were injured in a suspected rocket attack at a military base in Iraq. It comes as there has been a recent uptick in strikes on American forces and as tensions spike in the Middle East. The officials said troops at the Al-Asad Air Base were still assessing the damage. Meanwhile, as tensions mount between Israel and Iran, there are warning signs that threats by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to intervene could make things worse. Dorian Jones explains.
Tens of thousands protested across Turkey Saturday against Israel's war on Hamas. The protests were the latest sign of growing tensions in Turkey over the war in Gaza, which some observers say have been fanned by remarks by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan only a few days earlier. We need to be very strong so that Israel cannot do these outrageous things to Palestine, Erdogan said, adding that just as we entered Karabakh, just as we entered Libya, we can do something similar in Israel. There is no reason for us not to. Turkish flags flew at half-mast as Turkey marked a national day of mourning for the assassinated Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh. But Israeli analysts say Erdogan's military threats take the raging war of words to a new level. Galia Lindenstrauss is with the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
Once you use words of military threats, I think this is something you cannot ignore. Yes, many analysts say this will not happen tomorrow, but once you throw these things to the air, those who are in charge of the military have to prepare. And once you have preparations and you have plans, then of course you have to justify them in the future, and then you have to say the other side is threatening. And it has this sort of a circle of enmity that I think is dangerous.
But some say Erdogan's escalating rhetoric is more about the Turkish leader's bid to shore up his nationalist conservative voting base and his anger at being upstaged by countries like Qatar and Egypt in efforts to resolve the Middle East war. Filin Nasi is a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics Contemporary Turkish Studies Department.
Anti-Israeli rhetoric reflects a mounting frustration in Ankara for being excluded from the diplomatic processes to reach a ceasefire in Gaza and to plan a reconstruction project for in Gaza after the war.
China recently hosted Palestinian leaders, dealing another blow to Erdogan's efforts to appear as a key player in the diplomatic process. The Turkish president publicly vented his frustration, demanding that the Palestinian Authority leader, Mahmoud Abbas, apologize for refusing to accept an invitation to address the Turkish parliament. With Ankara enforcing a trade embargo against Israel and the war of words escalating, analysts warn the countries are now on an even more dangerous course. Galia Lindenstrauss is an analyst with the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
There's nothing left anymore to stop the leaders from going in dangerous directions. And once there's nothing more to threat in the civilian realm, then you get to the military realm, and that's dangerous.
As the conflict expands to Lebanon and possibly Iran, analysts warn Erdogan may find yet more opportunities to raise his rhetoric against Israel and further widen the conflict. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Democratic presidential candidate and current vice president Kamala Harris has narrowed her search for a vice presidential running mate. The AP's Shelley Adler has more.
After a weekend spent interviewing finalists, Vice President Harris must decide on her partner before the two set off Tuesday on a tour across key battleground states. Harris interviewed at least three running mate contenders on Sunday in Washington. They were Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. That's according to a person familiar with the process who spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity to discuss the negotiations. I'm Shelley Adler.
And speaking of running mates, Republican candidate Donald Trump last month chose Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. Vance went to law school at Yale, where he met his wife, Usha. She is a first-generation daughter of Indian immigrants who recently left her job at a top Washington, D.C. and California law firm. VOA's Dora McQuarrie has that part of the story.
38-year-old Usha Vance entered the national spotlight when she introduced her husband, J.D. Vance, at the Republican National Convention.
I met J.D. in law school when he was fresh out of Ohio State.
The daughter of Indian immigrants, Usha Kilakuri was born in California and raised Hindu. She and Vance married in an interfaith ceremony in 2014.
I grew up in San Diego in a middle-class community with two loving parents, both immigrants from India.
Usha Vance's parents are academics, as is her great aunt, a physics professor in India, where there is a lot of pride in Usha Vance's accomplishments. C. Santama is her great aunt.
I felt very proud of the situation because from my family, such a great intellectual has risen means it is something.
P. Srinivas Raju is the former village chief.
The news, I'm very happy, very happy.
Her former law firm profile says Usha Vance participated in a media freedom access clinic at Yale. She also worked at an Iraqi assistance refugee project there. She clerked for both Supreme Court Justice John Roberts and for Justice Brett Kavanaugh when he was at the Court of Appeals. Anita McBride, who once served as First Lady Laura Bush's chief of staff, says people who know Usha Vance speak highly of her.
Super smart, very collegial, got along with everyone, and just is a hard worker and a nice person. And you want to hear things like that about people that are maybe in public life. You know, I think it says something about their character, okay, that they're well-liked.
Usher Vance's status as the child of immigrants could help voters from marginalized groups see her husband in a new light.
He adapted to my vegetarian diet and learned to cook food from my mother, Indian food.
Kelly Dittmer is from the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University.
She's validating and serves as a validator for him with different, potentially different communities who might not think that J.D. Vance would understand them or perhaps, support or advocate for them.
What can the mother of three expect now that she's been thrust into the national spotlight? Again, Anita McBride.
Really picking apart your background, your heritage, your education, the jobs that you've chosen, it's all now fair game.
J.D. Vance says his wife is, quote, not a very political person. She is out on the campaign trail with him. Mrs. Vance resigned from her law firm when her husband became Donald Trump's running mate. Dora McCoy, VOA News, Washington.
And coming up later, a new way to think about cooling.
The technology takes advantage of radiative cooling, a natural phenomenon that requires no additional energy input.
This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Venezuela's top prosecutor has announced a criminal investigation against the opposition's presidential candidate, Edmundo González, and leader Maria Corina Machado over their call for the country's armed forces to abandon their support of President Nicolas Maduro and stop repressing demonstrators. Now, the armed forces are traditionally the arbiter of political disputes in Venezuela, but they've shown no signs of abandoning Maduro. The United States recognized González as the winner of the July 28th election. Global equities suffered heavy losses on Monday as Wall Street joined a global stock rout that started in Japan, while the dollar tumbled against the yen and U.S. Treasury yields dropped on concerns about a recession in the United States. Nicholas Ferrone is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I started our conversation by getting his reaction to how the U.S. markets responded to the sell-off that began in Asia.
Well, clearly investors are nervous, and as usual, it's easier to observe the market reactions than to explain it. So clearly, also, there are concerns about recession, but they're not the only ones. There is a broader climate of uncertainty, which is also partly linked perhaps to the election cycle. There are concerns about technology and what exactly is the kind of value that AI is creating. So I think we have seen a trigger for market reaction that we can discuss what the trigger actually was, whether it was more the jobs report, more about Japan. But what dominates is really the sense that investors are nervous. There's a lot of volatility, and it didn't take much to trigger something big in terms of market movements.
So let's talk about that, because when we look at the downside of the market, Japan was really hit. The Nikkei 225 really dropped. The Dow Jones, the benchmark of the U.S., shall we say, stock market, only dropped 900 points and closed at 38,000 plus, almost 39,000, down from around 40,000. So the percentage-wise in the U.S. drop on the benchmark market really wasn't that much. Where do you see the more concern? Is it more about the U.S. economy influencing others and the strengths of others like Japan and Asia?
I mean, one way to look at this is just that a number of investors have taken their gains from, stock market increases, stock prices increases in recent months, even in recent years. So when you have this movement in the market, that there's a feeling that now is the time to take your gain, cash in, and maybe invest it in something less risky, then there's a herd effect, right? You don't want to be the last one to do that. You want to be the first one, and everybody is rushing for the exit. I think we had a little bit of that today. So I would be perhaps overly cautious, but very cautious in terms of, putting something, a label on it in terms of how the market sees the U.S. economy or the future of AI or any other of these substantial themes. I think it was more a market correction, typical also in the summer. It often happens in the middle of summer when, you know, there aren't that many people around around the trading desk. And not necessarily that much driven by fundamentals.
Nicholas Veron is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Nicholas, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In other business news, a U.S. federal judge ruled on Monday that Alphabet's Google broke the law with its monopoly over online searches and related ads. It's the U.S. Justice Department's first victory against the monopoly in more than 20 years. The decision is a significant win for the Justice Department, which had sued the search engine giant over its control of about 90% of the online search market and 95% of smartphones. Hurricane Debby made landfall as a Category 1 storm in the Big Bend region of Florida's Gulf Coast early Monday morning, with heavy rains and winds of up to 128 kilometers per hour. The Hurricane Center predicted Debby would move offshore into the Atlantic by Tuesday evening and then re-strengthen and come back inland to unleash torrential rains on the coasts of Georgia and South Carolina later in the week. In Africa, Mogadishu residents marched on Monday on a beach where dozens were killed last week in one of Somalia's deadliest attacks in recent years. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
It was here on Friday that at least 37 civilians were killed and 212 injured in an explosion at a popular beach restaurant. Mogadishu resident Khadija Muhammad Ali said what took place was a national disaster and that someone needs to be held accountable.
We must defend our country from such enemies, and we must protect our people from such actions which keep recurring.
Friday's attack was the deadliest in Somalia since October 2022. Then, twin car bombs were detonated at a busy market intersection, killing at least 100 and wounding 300 more. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the Lido Beach attack by the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab group. It has claimed similar attacks in the past, including the 2022 car bombing. Al-Shabaab previously controlled a vast area of Somalia, but has been pushed back in government counteroffensives since 2022. However, the militant group remains capable of launching significant attacks on government, commercial, and military targets.
David Doyle reports for Reuters News. And finally, a California company is developing a material that can cool things by sending heat into deep space. Matt Dibble rounds us out.
They look like solar panels, but the system being installed on this department store roof will work quite differently. By sending heat into deep space, it will help cool the store below. The technology takes advantage of radiative cooling, a natural phenomenon that requires no additional energy input. In daytime, the sun's heat is mostly absorbed by objects on Earth and the atmosphere, but some heat in the infrared range still escapes, as if through a narrow window, to cold outer space. The film covering these panels is engineered to channel heat through that window, even on the hottest days.
It's focusing the infrared or thermal energy of an object and beaming it in this very specific wavelength to the upper atmosphere.
The panels contain a fluid, which the film chills to nearly 5 degrees Celsius, says the California firm SkyCool.
So it takes a relatively long loop, and the film is cooling that fluid as it travels.
The cold fluid is piped to the building's refrigeration system to give it an efficiency boost. The only energy this process uses powers a small pump to circulate the fluid.
SkyCool systems save a typical grocery store owner 15 to 20% of their refrigeration costs.
The cooling technology could have many applications. A project in India installed the film on vendor carts, lowering the ambient temperature below and helping to preserve fruit and vegetables longer. The company is also working on a roofing material for buildings in the developing world that lack air conditioning.
If you could cool those buildings without electricity, without water, and get them to a comfortable temperature inside, it has the potential to save lives, dramatically increase productivity around the world.
Taking advantage of the narrow window to cold outer space to cool a warming planet. Matt Dibble, VOA News, Roseville, California.
And on behalf of everyone here at VOA, we thank you for spending part of your day with us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.